This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. We usually tape in the offices of Raider, but today we're taping at my home. But I do want to thank Raider, a hands-on IT service provider that integrates all of your needs for advanced technical support, effective communication options, and cybersecurity. Raider's motto is, you just want it to work, we understand. Please visit RaiderSolutions.com for more information. I'd like to thank Iberia Bank, our premier sponsor. They support our community in so many ways, and their dynamic team is committed to serving the banking needs of clients in this region and throughout the southeastern United States. Iberia Bank offers the resources of a national bank with the personal touch of a community bank. Please visit IberiaBank.com for more information. The generosity of Lafayette General Health also makes this podcast possible. Lafayette General has been a leader in telemedicine. With the Health Anywhere app, your family can access quality urgent care at any time without an appointment, all from the comfort of your home. It's the waiting room redefined. Download the app today at lghealthanywhere.com.
Eric Knezik is our guest today. A founder and board director of Oceanetics, Inc., Eric is a graduate of Lafayette High and the U.S. Naval Academy, where he obtained his Bachelor of Science in Ocean Engineering with honors. He earned a Master's in Ocean Engineering from Texas A&M and is currently a PhD candidate in Systems Engineering at UL Lafayette. Eric has over 24 years of ocean engineering, fabrication, and marine installation experience, serving the Department of Defense Engineering Services contracts. He was a U.S. Navy Civil Engineer Corps officer, where he served as a CV officer deployed in Bosnia-Herzegovina in 1998. He was a dive officer with a focus on anti-terrorism, infrastructure, and port security barrier development and installation. His last 2 years in the Navy were after the USS Cole bombing in Yemen and the attacks of 9/11. He was highly decorated and awarded the highest honors, including the CV Combat Warfare Specialist Officer Qualification, Navy Dive Officer Qualification, Navy and Marine Corps Commendation Medal, Army Commendation Medal, Navy Meritorious Unit Commendation, and many, many others. Many of you know Eric locally, as he served from 2015 through 2019 as Lafayette Parish School Board member from District 8, where he also served as vice president and president of the board. Recent news about Eric's involvement in creating the FDA-approved Nurse Saver, known as NRSBR-100, alongside Dr. Doug, and I don't know if it's Clement or Clement, I'll have Eric, Clement, an ER doctor at Our Lady of Lourdes, is creating great excitement. The Nurse Saver protects healthcare workers who treat coronavirus patients and is the latest example of the creative force Eric Knezik brings to the forefront. Eric, welcome to Discover Lafayette.
Thanks.
Yeah. So this is a pilot for me. We're doing this on Zoom. And I'm grateful for the time you're taking, Eric. When I read the news over the weekend and saw the kind of the quick and amazing development that you and the doctor came up with, I thought it'd be good for people to get to know you better, the whole picture, where it's not just looking at you as perhaps a school board member or the director of Oceanetics, but kind of give your background and what led you to be able to even create a device such as this. So you want to start with your background? Were you, you know, growing up here?
Sure. Yeah. I grew up in Lafayette. My father was a Lafayette City police officer and retired in around 2000. My mom was in the banking industry, worked for several banks here in town. And, you know, so I was born here, Lafayette General, raised here, went through Lafayette public school system. When I graduated Lafayette High in 1992, I went to the Naval Academy. I was young, I was 17 years old. And yes, so graduated Annapolis, went on to graduate school, served my time in the Navy. And then I started my company around 2002, and then we had a kind of a resurrection and reforming in 2004. But Oceanetics was previously called Trustin, and we formed Trustin in 2004. I moved back to Lafayette in about 2005. So I've been here since.
What was it? I mean, your military service is incredible. If you can touch on that, how that molded you as a young man.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's kind of everything. It was the genesis of who I am today. It, Annapolis does a lot for young men and women to take them from being, you know, just high school knucklehead kids to, being competent enough to lead sailors and Marines in the fleet in just 4 years. It's a leadership laboratory, but it's also an excellent engineering school. I chose to go the ocean engineering route, which really set me up professionally because I'm actually one of those few people that actually works in the field that he studied in college.
It's unusual.
I have my whole career. I did it while I was in the Navy. And then since then, I've been able to build a company that does ocean engineering services. And but for me, the military was everything. It really turned me from, like I said, a kid into a young man. I think I was 23 years old leading troops in Bosnia. And there was a real contingency, real bullets. And just being that young and having that much responsibility. I was responsible for all the equipment we had there, all the weapon systems, ammunition, leading convoys. Just at such a young age, 23 years old, I remember because I turned 24 while I was there, and being there for such a long time, it's probably about a 7-month deployment for me. And at the time I had my daughter, who's now 23, was basically learning how to walk. So it was just it was a tough time for me as a young man, as a father, but it also taught me quite a bit, gave me the courage and confidence to do just about anything. At that point, I realized that if I could do that, if I could graduate Annapolis, if I could lead troops, then there's pretty much nothing I can't do.
Right. It takes away that fear because you've already survived.
Yeah.
So you were a dive officer, but you're saying you also were on the ground leading troops.
Right. My first tour, the Navy Seabees are construction battalions, and there were 8 active duty construction battalions. Their mission is basically combat construction, primarily to support the Marine Corps. So my first tour, essentially, in the Navy was with a Seabee unit out of Gulfport in MCB 133. And it was there that, I learned all about CB combat warfare and how to lead troops, especially in contingency timeframes. Also, civil construction and CB's mission is basically to build and, build fortifications, build the things that we need in wartime, runways, repairing railheads there, taking down fortifications, putting up fortifications, and being able to do that in an environment where, 1 minute you could be on a bulldozer or leading some sort of construction effort, and the next you may actually be defending the area that you're working on.
Right. So what prompted you when you were out of the service, I guess in 2002, what prompted you to become an entrepreneur? What led to this decision?
For me, I've always been driven to do, just kind of to do more. One of my personal reasons for leaving the Navy was that typically in the military, so long as you're performing well, you can look on a chart or know that in X amount of years, you're going to be a certain rank and you're going to be making a certain amount of money and you're going to have a certain type of lifestyle. And for me, although that's wonderful and it's a great career for a lot of people, for me, I wanted more. I didn't really want to be limited by my rank or my seniority within the Navy. I wanted to be able to basically perform to my own ability, and whether that's good or bad, have no limits upon what it was I wanted to do. One of the great things about owning my own business is that, we're primarily an ocean engineering company. We do ocean engineering services, but if I want to develop a medical device, I can, and I can really do anything that I want to do. And I wanted that freedom, within the realm of financial and fiscal responsibility and everything. I wanted to be able to do what it was I wanted to do.
Right. So your business was, when I met you, it was Trustin, and you've rebranded, and I guess I don't know if you've taken on new endeavors besides this medical device, but now you're with Oceanetics. So could you, when you talk about ocean engineering, what is that for lay people? Like just explaining, I guess, simply what a typical project would be.
So we were Trustin for, I think, right at 14 or 15 years. We've grown, Trustin has grown through, basically internal growth and expanding our capabilities, but we've also grown through acquisitions. And one of our latest acquisitions was one of our competitors in our federal market, and a company called Sound and Sea Technology. Sound and Sea was specializing in basically underwater acoustic analysis, cable laying, and kind of a high-end ocean engineering services for the U.S. Navy. Whereas our company, we did some of that stuff, but we primarily focused on fabrication and installation and maintenance services for those types of systems for the Navy. So anyway, this year we rebranded to Oceanetics once we combined the two companies last year. But ocean engineering is very similar to civil engineering, except it takes into account wind, wave, and currents. So basically, the structures that you would build on the land, while they do have to, you know, deal with wind, don't have to deal with wave and currents. So that's the simplest sense for what an ocean engineer does. My license is in civil engineering because, as far as I know right now, there's still no license in ocean engineering anywhere. And a lot of the universities, ocean engineering may actually be a subspecialty of civil engineering. And within ocean engineering, there's different tracks that you can do. So coastal engineering is one of those. Underwater life support is one of those. Offshore structures is one of those. But there's also a lot of other things like, you know, the interaction of a pier, like developing a pier, building a pier, fendering systems for ships when they come into a pier, underwater cable systems, underwater acoustic systems. Obviously, the Navy has a lot of systems out there that they use to listen to things and change different types of signatures on ships and whatnot. So those are the types of jobs that we do for the Navy. And then there's a whole anti-terrorism component of that as well,
which your experience comes in handy. You still dive? Do you still professionally dive as part of the company?
When the owner or a board director is diving for the company, it's probably not the most efficient or effective use of my time. But, you know, like I said, you know, part of the joy of owning a company is being able to do what I want to do. Although I'm qualified, I know I'm probably not the most efficient, but there are projects where I'm able to get in the water or to supervise guys getting in the water.
How deep do you dive?
For me, it's called air. I'm air qualified. So basically 190 feet.
Oh my gosh. Wow. I'm a pseudo diver. I can't handle the pressure well, but I know that below 100 feet is really, that's for the average person, not doable.
Yeah, it's really not recommended for someone who's not trained to do it. Yeah.
So it's if I may ask, just my husband would love this part. It's a special type of oxygen air.
No, you can dive on. So then that's what I was talking about. My certifications are all on air. Air diving, you can do up to 190 feet.
Okay.
Now, I mean, once you're below 130 to 150 feet on air, you have to consider things like nitrogen narcosis and whatnot.
I was thinking it would be. Yeah. That's great.
Right.
Yeah. Is it peaceful for you when you're at that depth?
I love being in the water. I love diving. When I was growing up, I wanted to be an astronaut. And that's the whole reason I went to Annapolis. So for me, at the time, that was the closest thing I could get to it.
Right. Eric, I'd like to pause, please, before we get to the next segment. We do a segment called Discover Lafayette's Past.
Discover Lafayette's Past is sponsored by Rally Marketing, a full-service digital marketing agency that can assist you with marketing automation, content development, search engine optimization, or show you how to use social media to turn into a moneymaker for your business. Our friends at Rally Marketing are there to help you navigate the maze of all the latest ways to market online effectively. For more information, please visit rallymarketing.com. And now the moment, which focuses on the history of the College of Engineering at UL Lafayette. In 1901, Ashby Woodson was the first teacher of manual training at the newly opened Southwestern Louisiana Industrial Institute, now known as UL Lafayette. Manual training was to eventually become known as the College of Engineering. Under a 1920 legislative act, Dr. Edwin L. Stevens, president of the university, organized departments that would eventually develop into colleges. The new engineering department was part of the College of Liberal Arts. Between 1930 and 1940, the addition of sufficient faculty members and course offerings enabled SLI to form four branches of engineering: chemical, civil, electrical, and mechanical. In 1939, the College of Engineering was officially designated, and in 1956, these four branches were accredited by the Accreditation Board for Engineering and Technology. A curriculum of petroleum engineering was added in 1953. The Department of Geology became a part of the College of Engineering in 1954, and in 1958, the master's degree programs were implemented in the College of Engineering. And that's a look back at part of our past at UL Lafayette.
So Eric Kanizek, we're talking about your career in the Navy and as owner of Oceanetics and what you do. And before we get to your new medical device, I wanted to ask you about the current COVID impact on the school system. I know you served a term and with distinction on the Lafayette Parish School Board. You served as a leader on the board. Any thoughts on where we are and the capability of the virtual online program? Do you have any thoughts that you've shared with people?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you that I think, you know, one thing, my service on the school board is one of the things I'm most proud of in my life. I've done a lot of really great things in my life and accomplished a lot of great things. But serving on the school board for Lafayette is actually probably one of those that tops my list. It's I chose not to run again, but I miss it every day. Mm-hmm. And but I'll tell you, the board, you know, I'm sure the board now is great. It's actually very close to the board that I was on with just a few other folks. But the board that I was able to serve with, I thought was fantastic. They, we had foresight and invested several years ago in Chromebooks for the majority of students within the parish. And so that in itself, I think, put us in a good position now so that although they're still probably having to buy more Chromebooks and help connect the dots as far as making sure that students and families have access to internet, I think the school system really put our, you know, parish in a good position with the foresight of buying Chromebooks and investing in a lot of that online learning systems and having the virtual school ready to go.
So the books that were bought, I've never really seen a Chromebook, but they last a few years, like the kids would turn them in.
Yeah, last several years.
Uh-huh. So the little people too, like even the small ones that
I'm not sure. Honestly, I don't remember how young, but I do know that we certainly middle schools and high schools have Chromebooks, and I think mm-hmm. they're filling the gaps now with the younger kids as well.
Yeah. It seems like even TV, like AOC or something, for smaller children, you know, that could have things that they could play along with or whatever. But I was just curious because as a parent, my girls are older now. They're in their 20s. I just think about what's happening with the parents, that there's a lot of juggling and uncertainty, you know.
For me personally, and my kids are grown now, so I'm not really facing this dilemma, but my my kids, who are grown now, their mom chose to homeschool them, or we chose to homeschool them from a pretty young age. I think it was first and second grade. So we were used to that self-paced learning environment. And I'll tell you, for my kids, it was a good thing. You know, when they got to college, they knew how to read the book. They knew how to teach themselves the curriculum. Now, you say teach themselves, they still needed guidance, and they still had questions, and they still needed assistance. But for the most part, they learned study skills that, I'll tell you, when I was a kid, I listened in class and that was enough for me. I didn't really know how to study until I got until I got to the Naval Academy. And then I'm like, wow, I really need to, you know, read the book and understand these concepts. So I guess it is a burden on the families. It will definitely be a burden on the families to make sure the kids are keeping up, to be able to make sure that they can access, if the parents can't answer the question, that the teachers are able to tend to the kids to answer questions. But it's definitely going to be an additional burden for them.
But I hear what you're saying, to teach kids that self-starting is a good thing to do, to be able to self-start.
It's a bad thing for kids to learn that it's their responsibility to educate themselves. You know, there are very few handouts in life, and that, you know, and maybe it'll, I mean, my hope is that kids learn to appreciate education a little bit more. The fact that the teachers will have to work hard, the parents are going to certainly appreciate the teachers a lot more.
Right.
And maybe the kids will appreciate their education a little bit more too.
Right. Not being an educator, but watching the system and seeing how the world has been evolving, I've almost wondered if this isn't not a blessing so much, but perhaps somewhat of a gift to get society to look at how we do everything, including how do we educate.
I do think, you know, I've had certainly a lot of conversations with friends about how everything, our work environment, our educational environment, is likely going to change permanently after this pandemic. You know, for me personally, my company, we've always been relatively virtual. My offices are throughout the U.S. We have a lot of folks that work from home. You know, so of our 50 employees, maybe 20 actually go into an office, maybe 25. The rest work from home or small offices on their own. So we had to be virtual. We have a lot of video conferences. We have a lot of group meetings. We use technology, different suites of technology, to make sure that we're all on board. We can work on joint documents together. So, you know, one of the things I'm thinking is that, you know, the companies that own a whole lot of office space might be in a bind in the future, because I just don't think that the demand for office space is going to be what it was in the past.
Right.
The same thing for, you know, schools. I think now, where our virtual academy, LPSS's virtual academy, was, let's say, sparsely used in the past, I think now that we've offered it to families, those that like it are going to want to continue to use it in the future. It provides so much flexibility, especially if the kids can keep up, pace themselves.
You can travel. Yeah, you can do
travel, right? Work from anywhere, you know.
Right, right. You know. Well, you're a self-starter, and I think that's a good good transition to talk about the new device that you and Dr. Clement, Dr. Clement,
yep,
from Our Lady of Lourdes. You're not in the medical device industry,
no,
but yet you, and I'm sure the doctor is the one that was seeing that doctors have been maybe protected a little bit more than all the other support staff, which are really with the patients much more often.
Right.
So can you talk about the Nurse Saver? I think the official name is in our SVR 100. How did this come about?
Yeah. Well, Doug and I are personal friends. And, you know, when COVID happened, we had an opportunity to talk a lot about, you know, what is it, you know, what's the future? How can we help? What are your risks? Dr. Clement was instrumental in starting the initial COVID screening facility at the Cajun Dome. And he basically helped develop the methods developing the methods for testing and keeping healthcare workers safe. So Doug came to me with an idea. There were basically, they were called intubation boxes, intubation hoods. And they were plexiglass boxes with big holes for hands to go in that acted kind of as a splash shield, essentially, if a physician was going to intubate a patient. As I understand it, again, I'm not a physician, that when physicians are intubating COVID patients, a lot of the times their lungs are filled with fluid at that point, once they're in the ER and they've decided to go to the hospital. And so when they intubate these patients, that fluid obviously comes out of the patient and aerosolizes, and basically you have these contaminants that spread throughout the room. So the initial concept for an intubation box was basically something you could find on the internet. And it was nothing more than like kind of like a splash shield that would go around a patient's head. The concern that Doug had was, okay, if I'm the physician and I'm intubating the patient, maybe that provides me some protection. But what does it do for
the people on the
five or six people, the nurses and other healthcare workers that are standing around assisting me, you know, pumping the AMBU bag, working all the monitors and whatnot. So we started talking about it. And he said, you know, if we could somehow apply negative pressure to this, it really would work. It would really be effective. And we could call it the Nurse Saver. And because basically we're saving nurses. So I came up with an acronym for Nurse Saver, and then came up with, you know, within the next day, I think it was the next day or two, I had drawings in front of them of concepts that we had on how we could basically contain from the shoulder up. So basically from the shoulder of the patient up through the head to where we contain all the contaminants within this box, essentially still provide access to the physicians and healthcare workers for the ability to do intubation, apply oxygen, all the monitors and whatnot that you have to have. So we worked with, you know, we worked through the drawings and we edited them a little bit. And within a couple more days, I had a prototype built. We sent it down. We tested it on a dummy, and then we tested it on healthy people just to make sure that we could access it. We tweaked it a little bit, added some features, and then came up with the final prototypes.
So it pumps in the oxygen, the air that the patient needs, but then it's a negative pressure space. If you can explain
that. Doesn't pump in, it actually sucks out. So the system is built so that the patient's upper body, the cephalic region, that's a term, again, I'm not a physician, so I had to learn what this term meant, but basically the region of the head, head, neck, and shoulders are contained within the box. It has a shroud that seals, and you have to, in order to make any kind of negative pressure environment, we had to have some sort of a seal. It has armholes on the sides and the back that allow the physician and healthcare workers to access it. But the armholes are developed so that they have a shroud, basically, that it sleeves your arm, and it has an internal flap, so keeping the contaminants in. Then we apply a suction. It has two valves on either side where we can apply the hospital, basically hook it up to the hospital suction. And essentially we're sucking air into the box and through the hospital suction system, not allowing the contaminants to escape. And so long as we have negative pressure on the box, we have air flowing into the box and not out of the box. And that's kind of the secret of the whole thing. As long as we can maintain airflow into the box and not out of the box, we know that we are containing and evacuating the contaminants. Now you combine that with the PPE that the physicians and the healthcare workers are already wearing, and we're significantly increasing the safety environment of the healthcare workers. One of the other interesting things about the device is, initially, and again, I'm not a physician, but I'm telling you what I've learned. Initially, the primary treatment for COVID patients, once they got to a certain point, was to put them on a ventilator.
Right.
The thing about being on a ventilator is it's a closed system. Closed system means that the air that they breathe out basically is contained within the ventilation system. So that the air that they breathe out that's contaminated with COVID, essentially, is still contained within the ventilator system and then filtered. Now, there are other methods of treatment that you can use for COVID patients. One of them is called BiPAP, and the other one is called high C, which is basically high pressure oxygen, or BiPAP, similar to a CPAP machine. The issue with those types of methods is it's not a closed system. The air that the patient would breathe out would be contaminated with COVID. Now, you might not necessarily want that in a hospital environment for that patient to be breathing out contaminants. So this device, if you use this patient to contain those contaminants, can significantly reduce the COVID contaminants that are exposed in the hospital environment. It can also be used to transport. If you imagine a COVID patient that you were transporting from ER to ICU, you could put the patient in this device, also contain the contaminants that way.
What about the family and other people that want to visit? Would this give them a safer space?
It would give them a safer space. I mean, one of the initial benefits, and I've talked to a lot of physician friends, is that if you remember initially, we had a significant shortage of PPE, significant shortage, and that was one of the main concerns. Well, if you have a patient in this device and you know that the negative pressure environment is there and you know that air is going in, then a healthcare worker wearing PPE, they call it universal precautions, could check on the patient. And instead of changing all their PPE out before they go to a new patient, they would be able to basically reuse the same PPE that they're in to visit a new patient, so long as they're still contained in one of these nurse-saver devices. As far as family visiting, you know, I don't know what the protocols are. I know that they're keeping family away from COVID patients, which is really, really tragic. I can't imagine losing a, you know, a family member going to the hospital being ill, and then that's the last you ever see of.
I know.
This device would, again, it makes it safer for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Can the patient talk through this shield? Like, are they maybe heard?
Essentially, it's a plexiglass barrier along with rubber. So it's plexiglass and rubber combination and barrier. So the patient, you know, you can still talk to the patient, access the patient. The medical people can put the all the monitors that they need to monitor the patient as well.
I don't know if you know this. I've read that some patients do better when they're flipped to lay on their stomachs. You know, this device, could it still work if you were not?
Yeah, it does allow for that. That was one of the initial design criteria that we established is, well, what if they're in this, you know, orientation, if they're on their stomachs, will it still work? And yes, it does. That was one of the reasons that we made, you know, the design features as they are.
Have you been in, I mean, if, I don't know anybody, I haven't been in the hospital, and I've lost one friend that was in his 70s that had a lung disease. I don't have a lot of contacts with people that have had COVID. Have you experienced that yourself? I mean,
Well, it's, you know, I'm just kind of starting to get to a point where some of my friends that I know have COVID or have recovered from COVID. So, but initially, no, I didn't know anyone. But now, yeah, it's a little bit alarming because, I mean, now I know people who actually have it or have recovered from it.
We've learned so much. It seems the medical community in the 4 months we've been going through this, they've learned so much since those early days. Like you said, being on a ventilator isn't really the best option for people if they want long-term health.
Right. I mean, there's long-term negative effects of being on a ventilator. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you can avoid it, that's great as far as I understand it.
Yeah, I know. Well, I appreciate you. I appreciate you being with us. Where can people find out more about this? Do they go to your website, Oceanetics?
Yeah, we have a couple. Well, a lot of people in Lafayette know how to reach me.
Yeah.
I'm pretty easy to find. But we have a website. It's called intubationhood.com. Mm-hmm. You can also go to our company website, oceanetics.com. Innovationhood is spelled just like it sounds, innovationhood.com. Or you can just do a Google search. We'll probably pop up. Mm-hmm. The Nurse Saver is NRSAVR. It's an acronym. And we made sound fancy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I understand these are much more cost effective than having to pressurize the entire rooms. And so,
right. This is, hospitals are equipped with isolation rooms. They're only equipped with a handful of them. Mm-hmm. And the cost of an isolation room, you can imagine, is basically the cost of an entire room with maintaining, basically they maintain a pressure differential so that the, air goes into the room, not necessarily out of the room, and the air coming out of the room is contained. So this provides the ability to have multiple isolation, not necessarily isolation rooms, but isolation, increases the isolation capacity of a hospital, really 100-fold. I mean, you could have an unlimited amount of these devices, keep your healthcare workers safer.
Right. Well, best wishes on this. I know that Lafayette General is a sponsor of our show, and I understand that they have some. I know you're hoping to have mainstream buy-in for this, you know, to help people that need help the most.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we developed this to try to help people, and obviously we wanted to help our community first. I mean, I guess we're selfish in that way, but we certainly wanted to help our community first. So the first couple of units we gave, we haven't sold any. We've given them away to Lafayette General. We can only do that so long before I can't sustain it financially. But but we certainly
entrepreneurship thing kicking in.
Right. Yeah. You can only do it so long. But we provided the first few units to Lafayette General. They've been very helpful, very gracious in accepting them and giving us feedback. And but certainly we want to get them out there as fast as we can.
Right. Well, Eric Knezik with Oceanetics, thank you for taking your time today to share your story. I think, as my good friend Greg Otris says, you really exemplify that wildcatter mentality. You know, like you learned in the Navy, you can do what you put your mind to.
Yes, ma'am.
And I'm proud to call you my friend. Thank you for being here today. And I'd like to thank our listeners and also our sponsors. First, we've got Iberia Bank, Lafayette General Health, Raider Solutions, and Rally Marketing. I appreciate the support of these companies in helping make this podcast possible. You can go to discoverlafayette.net to hear Eric's interview and all of our other 160 interviews we've done today. It's a really great cross-section of our community and other leaders such as Eric Knezik. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, this is Jan Swift. Thank you for joining us.